music session number 28729, Reel 7.
Riverdale, Reel 7. So, when you were doing these, the initial sort of, I was thinking of that first 6 months of Jungle Patrols, am I right in thinking that there's relatively few contacts in that period because of the situation? Mm. And then you'd have this period of a month where you kind of...
Recuperated
from that. How confident at that stage were you of your growing skills in the jungle?
Well, I'd turned into a man. I was an 18-year-old lad. I turned into a man that time, and there I was. We all were a fighting force. And I thought to myself, I wouldn't like to meet our lot. I wouldn't like to be opposite to our chaps, because they were so quick in responding, and they didn't dither about at all. And I checked with the chaps, and I said, were you sort of shit scared? They said, no, we were a bit excited, but not scared. No, you're bubbling with excitement. But I never thought of frightening going into an area. I didn't like going in the swamps because of the snakes. They're an unknown factor. But I wasn't frightened of going into the patrol. I didn't like the energy we expelled because it was another massive walk. And of course, a man being idle, we'd rather stay on our beds or do some play football against the Gurkhas or another team. But we had to do it, and we did it. And I thought, well, no, I've never been scared. And some of the blokes, there was a few chaps who did go, and they were shipped out. But you never hear about them. It's just that one chap actually in Bowlock was shipped out. And but they shipped him out because he had very bad acne. And they couldn't cure it because of the heat out there. His acne wouldn't recover. But he admitted to me that he was also shipped out because he was a bit frightened. Going back, one of the person who lives in Hitchin, he disappeared off the scene and became an officer, a waiter in the officer's mess. So I said to Smudge, his name is, of course, Smythe, why did you do that? He said, well, the one ambush I told you about, well, we had another one 2 days afterwards. And he was on the same one as me. Now, he couldn't take it anymore. Because when we laid this meat at ambush the second time, they were supposed to walk along the track that we made an immediate ambush on. But they'd gone off the track 50 yards above us and came in behind us. Now, one of the bandits kicked one of my mate's feet and hadn't even seen him. So we had to bring our weapons round the back, a brain gun and everything else, to our back, and we had to sort of sit in a sitting position and blast them 5 yards away. And closer sometimes. And that was quite successful as well, but because... It threw us, the fact that they didn't comply with the regulations of walking in front of us, they walked behind us. And this smudger, that got him, that frightened him. It was out of context, you see. It was out of training. He didn't get that, so he got out the activity. And not many blokes did fall out because they stood the ground. Several blokes went in the SAS when they left us.
One of the things you mentioned is, you know, we've chatted about the kind of contacts that you had and the way that the unit would fire.
Yes.
And that they would be over very quickly. Was there any... can you describe to me the sort of weapons and things that you were using and the things that you would do to stop the terrorists? You mentioned to me off the tape slightly about how a carbine, what its capabilities are. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, the Bren gun was the best one because it put the firing power second to none, and it was a 303, a rather large round. And it had a very good penetrating area with that round. It would mostly go through you if it didn't hit bone. And we'd hoping that it'd either take some equipment with them or hit the bone. Then that would probably knock them down. They would eventually die. In fact, they'd die quickly. The other ones were short range weapons, apart from the rifle. The Irving gun was short range. The carbine was short range. They did have, in the early days, Tommy guns, but they were so heavy. 9mm, they were big rounds, but they were too heavy to manoeuvre. Slow in action as well. And somehow they were actually the weapons that the top bandits had got. They thought that having a Tommy gun was their top one. But mostly they were used in 12-bore shotguns, French and British and German, which were all right close range, but no good far distance. They spread too far. To give you another instance, that we came onto a track, and as soon as we came on the track, we looked to our left, and this communist was standing at a like a sentry post, and he was smoking. So he hadn't got his hand on the weapon. So we fired and killed him. But that aroused the camp that held over 150, just further up, 200 yards up from the track. We heard these bugles going, trying to assemble them, and we rushed up there. The EY man, with the extra yield, fired a hand grenade, and it went right over the camp to the other side. So the communists thought we were on that side, so they rushed towards us. And there was only 7 or 8 of us. And we had to get away from them. We were in a vulnerable position, so we had to spread out, run back and spread out, and try and pinch them as they came through on both sides, hoping that we wouldn't hit each other. Well, I turned around and went smack straight into a tree, laid myself out, and when I was coming to, the ground was going underneath me, and two blokes had got hold of my shoulders, my shirt, and pulling me, and pulled me out the danger zone. And when the bandits realised that they were running into us, because we put a firepower down, that slowed them down a bit, and eventually turned and ran again, I was more worried about losing my hat, never mind about the enemy going shooting at us. I wanted my hat. I've got that formula. I wanted that right. So as we ran back towards them, I picked my hat up and ran into the camp, sprayed it with the rounds around, and we only got 4 others. So we killed the sentry and 4 others, and there must have been over 150. And they had lecture platforms there, flags up there. They had proper huts, built huts out of bamboo. They'd been there for years, and nobody knew about it. So we burnt it down, of course. And that's when we were talking about the fact that we were so far in that we had to get identification. So we couldn't carry 5 of them out. Now, we couldn't do it, but we had a Dayak from Borneo headhunt us. So we asked him to do the honours. So he cut the heads off in the left hand, and we carried them back for identification. It was a bit against the grain, because I couldn't watch it, even though I was hardened to the fact there, but I didn't watch that. And we hadn't got time to bury them, so we just stacked them and just put some leaves and branches over them, and the animals would get to them or they'd rot away very quickly.
What was the importance of the identification, and how important was identification?
Well, they wanted to know what leaders they'd got, what secretaries they'd got, and they were like a communist. They were communists, so they had committees, and they wanted to know what per member of the committee, substantial or otherwise, was on, so they could eliminate them, because most of these chaps had money on their heads. But the army couldn't claim. You mentioned that Raymond Hans. Well, Raymond Hans killed one of the most leading bandit, Lukon Kim. We were all after him for years, and Ray got him, and there was $20,000 reward, but Ray couldn't get it. The army couldn't get it.
You mentioned that the size of this large camp, where there'd been about 150.
Yeah.
What were the normal sort of terrorist camps that you came across?
18 to 24, and sometimes only 6. You know, I referred to the fact that one of our officers shouted out, "Enemy left, fire," and we fired, and I cut this tree down. Well, unbeknown to us, we're walking through a swamp, and it was only probably just below our knees. Well, he actually bumped a rail track, and it was a miniature rail track used by the loggers, the Malayan loggers. And he'd got onto this track and looked to his left, and they'd built a little hut on the railway track, these bandits, and there's 2 of them. And both of them were surprised, but Kelly was quicker than they were, and he killed both of them without hesitation. In the meantime, they throwed a hand grenade at him, and he landed at his feet, smoking. And he said to the blokes immediately to him, "Get down, there's a hand grenade." And he didn't move. And he didn't go off because he had a damp fuse. Because dampness is terrible in the jungle. You to keep this stuff clean and dry. And of course their equipment was old and old and old. In fact, it may have been ones that the British had dropped in the war. But Kelly was so calm, collective there. And we walked down further down the track and made camp, because it was no good going any farther, because everybody knew we were there. The firepower we put down, the echo was still echoing when we walked down. You could hear it going around the valley, and so everyone knew we were there. But he said, "So we won't go any further." He said, "We were well in, but we'll stay here for the night." And that's where we lost the chap who couldn't get back to the camp, because he wandered off the wrong direction. You don't know where the hell they are. You haven't got any stars to see, because the trees were covering up. And of course, you see, when you take a compass bearing, that's all right, but you usually just follow the sun. And you've got to remember the sun goes round in a circle, so make adjustments to it. But the sun, you couldn't see the sun in the jungle. You only see it in the rubber or the scrubland. So you had to take a compass bearing.
One of the things that strikes me as well when you were doing this is, you know, considering that you were quiet and that you would move in the best that you could through the jungle, one of the things that always amazes me is actually that you would smoke in the jungle.
Oh, yeah.
Would that ever give you a position?
Oh, yeah, well, that's what I said. They could spot us because of our sweetness, our sugar sweetness, and our tobacco was different to theirs.
But smoking was still allowed as such, was it?
Yeah, you couldn't stop. No, we wouldn't go in. If we couldn't smoke, we wouldn't go in. How did we get the leeches off? No, as soon as you're on patrol, and the worst thing was to have a non-smoking officer, because he wouldn't stop so much. But then Kelly was so fit and virile that I remember an occasion when he went to the top of this hill, right, he said 10 minutes, he lit up, he looked at the view, he'd had a smoke. He finished his cigarette by the time we got up there. And he said, right, we're off now. I said, whoa. We haven't had a smoke yet. You should carry that keeper. I said, you tell us not to bunch up. So he had to wait for a bit, you see, but at least he was considerate that way. But you see, you get so spread out, even 10 of you. I remember the time when I stopped to have a pee, and I was third man in the line from the back. The other two passed me. So I was peeing away and looking around like that. I thought, I could still hear them going on. Finished my thing, put my rifle in the usual position, the cradle position in front of me. Looked at it, I couldn't see them. I could see the track going, and within 10 yards, the track had disappeared. I didn't know if they'd gone left or right. So I thought, it's no good. Me go, which way are we going? I hadn't taken the compass bearing. You rely on your leader. So I had to shout out, and the echo went right through, and they came running back, thought I was in trouble. And when I told him, he was bloody annoyed. I said, well, I told the last two lads that I was having a pee. They should have holed up, you see, and slowed the group up. But Kelly got his head down, and he was going on. He wanted to get through this patch and go into the open country or something like that, or get the patrol over with. If he hadn't got a feeling that he was going to bump anybody, he wasn't interested. You know, he did. We've heard of blokes, patrols going into the jungle, sitting down as soon as they get in the jungle. They're just in the suffix, and it must have happened to all the other ones. And we were dumbfounded. It never happened to us. And the sergeant would get a paper out, and a newspaper or a comic, and sit there for 2 or 3 hours and then go back to the road. So he's done his patrol. And they were regulars. Now, we found that some of the regulars were much more idle than we were. They were in for an easy life. And they found out that some of these regulars signed on for a long, long while, 20 years and over, had the cushy jobs. They were in the stores in Trieste, in Germany, Cyprus, Palestine, wherever the British Army, and they got these cushy numbers. No, they were still fit. They'd had the training, not the jungle training, but they had the training. So they got them all out of these offices, hundreds of them, and shipped them out to the active regiments. And they didn't like that. They had to earn their pay, and they didn't like that. So if they rose to a sergeant or something like that, they would do that and make an easy life. But somehow they got found out, and they were sort of struck across the hand with a ruler or something like that, or really, or money was taken away from them, or they were disgraced.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier was about, obviously, the contacts that you would look for, bits and pieces in the bandits' equipment.
Yeah.
What type of things would you look for when you either captured a bandit camp, or if you had an active engagement, what would you be looking for? Would it be documents or maps? Or
you said both things there. It was mostly documents, but weapons. Weapons were the first thing. Get the weapons away from them, recover them and the ammunition. Then find out the documentation, but we couldn't read Chinese, so we used to take everything. They often had money, piles of money with them. Mostly Malayan money, some Chinese money. And any information you could find, their patrol routine and things like that. They wouldn't be daft enough to put their camps down on the maps, because they knew where it was. They'd go back. We didn't have to have a map to find out our base camp. That was the thing as well. You'd go out from the main camp where the regiment or the company was situated. You then go out and make another camp. And then you do patrols from that camp and make smaller camps, like base camps in a mountain. So then you'd come back to the camps, wrap up, and then come back to the other camp, and then back to your own camp. Sometimes you had a job to find it, but usually the officers were quite good on reading. but mostly our trackers.
That was the other question I wanted to know about. Can you tell me a little bit about the EBAN trackers as well that you would...
Worth every penny they were, blokes were. They were bloody marvellous. They could read a sign. Held up one patrol, pointed down to this great big paw mark. It was probably 8 inches across, and it was a tiger. And he'd walked, he said, within the hour, in less than an hour, this tiger had walked in front of us. And we followed the track, not because of that, because it seemed to be going the same way. A tiger will go a natural route, you see, so we were going a natural route. It wasn't made by man, it was made by the contours and the vegetation, so we followed that through. It was going in the general direction we wanted to go. Then we heard a noise, and it was a noise, a human noise, not an animal noise. And they were walking along, this group of people came along, two Europeans, and they were tiger hunting, and they were on the track of this tiger. They were walking through the jungle with a proper, and they were on an expedition. They paid for this expedition, they were going out looking after animals. We had a chat with them, a smoke with them, and so forth. One was a French, and the other one was an Arab, I think.
Are there any other incidents that spring to mind during that period you were there?
What, amusing or otherwise?
Anything.
You got to think of that. You know when I meet up at Minden, every year we meet up at Minden, and some of the boats got fantastic memories. And he said, can you remember so-and-so? And I thought, I can't remember that. But I do remember one that reminded me of that. I hadn't done my corporal stripes very long. So, Mr. Kelly, Lieutenant Kelly, decided to do a patrol. And he was going to stay out 2 or 3 nights. So on the first day, he dropped my section, me and my section, at this house. Stay there, he said, and keep inside if you can, as much as you can. 300 yards further on, there was another Attab house. He put another section in there. And then he went on to patrol the rest of the area. Well, we're just getting settled down, and one of the blokes said, "Here, Birdie, there's a woman coming down on a bike." So I said, "Oh, God." She looks pregnant. They wear those clothes. They reveal everything about the figure. They're long, skirty things with trousers, like cut in the side, and these big, big round hats. And a lot of these were messengers, you see. So we went out and stopped her. And from the little Chinese I knew, she got her papers out. Well, they'd automatically get the papers out. And I looked up there, and the blokes were looking out at the top. Because you could see out of the section at the top there. And they looked a bit amused. So I said to her, we checked the bike, but we didn't take the saddle off. And they got she was a courier, and she had this message in a tube. Found out afterwards. So I let her go on, because I didn't want anything to do with a pregnant woman. I mean, because you're not going to stop, alter the war. So these blokes came down. And they started laughing. And I said, "What are you laughing at?" They had the same situation. They walked by and said, "Oh, Christ, she's pregnant." Oh, he said, "Let Birdie have it. He'll kill her." I said, "Where did you get that from?" He said, "Well, we thought you were the ones who were going to do it, not us. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't shoot her." I never thought of shooting her. But the women were as bad as the men. They used to come towards you with a hand grenade, you know, in a basket.
Were they used mainly as couriers?
Most of those couriers, yeah.
You didn't encounter any in the camps?
Yeah, they were all in every camp, but they were couriers as well. Morale boosters, but never prostitutes. Never that way inclined. The women that we got caught there, they were all Virgo intactors. 16, 17-year-old girls, so they had a great respect for that. They were a well-organised organisation. A little bit too... method. They got too closely to the method. Not the Germans. If you couldn't do that, it's not worth doing. You've got to do it properly. You know, we want this. And they couldn't do that. Their reception was terrible. They couldn't rely on radio. So they had to have couriers going across Malaya. So by the time they got there, the event had finished, it was over with, and they'd gone. So they had to go hunting them where they got, because they used to move camp pretty regular.
You know, when you mentioned that about the pregnant woman on the back, was she later obviously detained?
Yeah, so that was she was found. Yeah, when Kelly came back and collected us on the way back two or three nights afterwards, we went back to where this campon was, and the police officer came out and met Kelly. And they were talking about this and said, yes, there's this woman on the bike. She was pregnant, unfortunately, but we found out she was a messenger. They arrested her. He said they could speak the language, they could talk, and they could see by the... She was frightened to death. I could see she was frightened, poor girl. And she was a married woman, she may have had kids at home. I didn't want to do anything like that to her. I haven't got any evidence, anyway. But you did feel a bit rotten, the fact that she'd got right through you and pulled you. But I think she was genuinely scared. They were frightened of it.
What about your leisure time? Would you have any leisure time, or what did you do for you?
We didn't have a lot. We used to lie around a lot, but then we used to read and write home. That's another thing as well. You mentioned about, did that affect my parents? My first letters, and I've read them as well, when I came back, told them about the incidents that we had, and we killed this and killed that, and one of the blokes got a bullet near his, whizzed past his ear, and another one got trapped with his feet between in a log and broke his ankle and all that. And I was telling her, and the swamps and the snakes, and we came across a tiger the other day, and I was telling her all this, you know, and I was frightened her to death. And I thought to myself, what are you doing here, you silly devil? So I altered the whole thing, you know, because I thought, she was worried to death, that's why she got shingles. What a girl. No, I stopped that. I had to change the attitude.
So did you ever get any time in sort of Singapore?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, that's the point.
Just as a break?
We went to KL. If we were in off-duty, we went in Sundays mostly, we went to Kuala Lumpur, because it was only about 15 miles away. That was entertaining. You had to take your weapons with you, then put them into an office in the Ordnance Corps, sign them, get a chip, and then collect them on the way out. But you couldn't take your weapon into... the city. It was reasonably safe. We had fights in there and so forth like that, but there again, that was the British against the rest of them. I did have a spell in Singapore and stopped at a place called the Sanders Home, which was run by a religious group, beautifully and clean. They didn't pester you with religion. If you'd like to come to a service, you're more than welcome. They didn't expect us to swear or smoke too much, and to be back reasonable time, and if we are back late, to please observe the silence. And we did, and I enjoyed it. I was there, and that was broken by the fact that, unfortunately, the High Commissioner Gurney was killed in an ambush. So they wanted every available people, so we had to get back onto the train and report back in. But I don't know what our six of us would do up there, but we were straight on patrol, and it was 2 days afterwards, and we thought, well, it's just a gesture, you know. They'd gone and fled and so forth. Did you read? Anybody tell you about Gurney?
You also had a period attached to the SAS in Korea during the middle of that, didn't you?
Oh, that's never volunteer. God. Well, actually, I didn't. It's just the fact that I suppose my enthusiasm got in front of me. I mentioned the fact that the Australian Air Force wouldn't drop supplies to us because they couldn't identify the area. So we used to have a little bit of abuse over the radio. And we knew the Australians were a bit cocky. And there is an undercurrent of the fact that bloody convicts and all that kind of thing. Of course, we just say that, you know. How did you get out of jail? You should be put back in bloody jail. And all your... And anyway, so... To communicate with the patrol people at us and the Australians, I went to see Lucy Fields, the CO. He called for me and he said, oh, you're off to a place called Butterworth. And it was an air force. And, right, I said, okay. So I went in there, and the camp was actually run by, it was in actually EPO, but it was run by the SAS. So they had to give identification to us, so we had to take our cap badge off and put SAS cap badges on. So while we were there, we were attached to the SAS. And most of the blokes, funny, they had their own cap badges on. Some of them were engineers, artillery, infantry lot. So some of them used to wear two cap badges. not in a jungle, but on parade, anything like that. So we used to wear two cap badges, Suffolk and the SS. And that allowed us to get through the gate quicker without too much red tape and so forth. And what we were doing, they put us on in Dakotas, and we were to make up the crew for dispatching. So there we were, flying over the jungle, going to this DZ dropping zone to feed our chaps. And we found out how difficult it was for them to spot, even though we came down 200 or 300 feet, to 200 or 300 feet. We still couldn't see them, unless they were in open ground. But if they're in anywhere near jungle, even if they cleared it down, you couldn't see the smoke. It was travelling across the top of the trees, as I said. So we had to identify. So I was with the pilot and saying to him, at the back of him, once sitting down, I said, now, he will give you instruction to get, and bang, you're over the top now. Can you cause that? So do the same thing again. So we're approaching it now. I can just see him now, bang, and he let go. So at least we got him 200 or 300 yards away from him, instead of 3 miles away.
And how would that be delivered? How is the
parachute?
And what's it wrapped up in? Is there any...
No, it's only in crates. No, just in crates and straps. But they'd come down about 30 miles an hour, so if they hit right, they were all right. But I had one occasion when I came back from a when they said to us, look, you're all going shooting now, we're going on a right little range, and I've gone for my corporal stripe. So I got this award, the fact of my shooting, and I got my corporal stripe. We went on a patrol, and it was a 30-day patrol. And on the first feed we had from the airdrop, one chute landed up in a 60-foot tree, caught up there with its... And it was too high and too big, and it was sticking out away from the tree for anybody to climb up and try and cut them down, see? So they had a little chat amongst themselves, and they said, Burdett, you're supposed to be a bloody good shot, shoot it down. Well, it was still swaying like that, you see? So I had to wait for it to sway and then try and get the strapping. So I eventually cut the strapping down, and bang, it came down. And all the blokes leapt on it because it was a rum ration, and all the mail, and also the change of clothes. Well, unbeknown to me, 2 or 3 rounds had gone in the bottom of the crate, and it had gone through the rum. And the socks were going like that with rum, trying to get the rum out. And the letters were saying, Dear Harry, boom, great big hole in it. Now, what did they say there? They'd never forgive me for that. But now, when I did probably half a dozen deliveries with that, we had to fly off with it, and I was a terrible flyer, same as I was, oh God. They used to call me the brown paper bag man. You got your bag, Ray? Yeah, yeah, all right, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the pilot used to say, hang on, Ray, we're going down, and I thought, oh, bloody hell. And then you're all hanging out the fuselage, making sure they got, oh dear. And you're strapped in. So they said, though, we've got permission from your CO, get some warm clothing, you're on a long-distance flight. I said, oh, right. So we caught this flight, and it was a load of boxes in, cartons, not cartons, crates, mostly Swedish writing on the top. And it was, not UNESCO, it was United Nations. I think it was United Nations, that's right. And, of course, the British were more involved with the career now. We didn't know we'd done a career. And we didn't fly over much land. We had to land in islands to get refueled because wherever we couldn't go across. And I thought, where the bloody hell are we? We were 3 days flying and lying on these straps things that there was like an open strap hammock aside. And it was cold, no heating in the back of the Dakota. And it dropped, and you know, oh dear, 200 or 300 feet used to drop. You get these air pockets. And it was an old prop engine, you know. And we landed up in Korea. And it was January 1951. It was bloody freezing. And so the Yanks, thank God, had gave us some big overcoats and some, like, these big anoraks with fur inside. And all we had to do is deliver these crates and then get back. But the crew wanted to stay overnight at Seoul, the Australian crew, you know. They didn't want to go straight back. They wanted to go and have their drinkies and stuff down in Seoul. We were probably 50 miles away from Seoul. That night, I thought, hello, we're attacking. And I thought, Christ, I haven't brought me weapons. So I said to the American who was sleeping in our basher, I said, is there any spare weapons we can have? What do you want them all for? I said, what's going off outside? Oh, he said, that's the trees exploding. It was below 30. And the bark was exploding with a sap. And I thought it was, you know, attacking. He said, no, we haven't had any trouble here since the last retreat. The Americans retreated from there. But, oh, God. So I went out, I was going to go outside, and the Yank said to me, where are you going, boy? So I said, I'm going to have a pee. He said, pee in that bucket. He said, otherwise it'll drop up out there. It was so cold. Do you know your eyeballs started freezing up? The glucose in your eyeballs. And then when the Americans came up and said, oh, where's these limeys, you know, these British blokes, and they'd gather around, give us the fags. And they said, where are you situated? And I said, well, we're in Malaya. Oh, Christ, I wouldn't do that. They were quite not happy being in Korea, but they'd rather fight in Korea than they would Malaya. Malaya frightened them. They didn't like the jungle.